Welcome to Managing Myeloma. I am Dr. Philip McCarthy. In today's presentation, I will be reviewing testing strategies throughout the myeloma disease lifecycle. I will begin with presenting symptomatology and diagnostic recommendations for patients suspected of having multiple myeloma, including prognostic tests to be considered as part of the initial workup. I will conclude my presentation with a discussion of patients who relapse from complete remission, as well as those who develop frank disease progression. So let's begin. On the left-hand column, you'll see the standard CRAB criteria for presentation. These are patients who usually have fairly advanced disease. They will present with bone pain or back pain, anemia, renal failure as manifested by a rising creatinine, and hypercalcemia, often with the symptoms of fatigue and somnolence. Now, age is something that people think about. The average age is approximately 70 years for a myeloma patient at presentation, but not all patients are above 65 to 70 years of age. We've had patients as young as in their late 20s present with multiple myeloma, so it's something to be considered in the presentation. It's not always the older age patient. Family history can be important. Sometimes myeloma will run in the family. And as well, race. There's a greater incidence in African Americans, and it's often a more aggressive disease in the African American population. A lot of patients with myeloma will have a pre-existing MGUS or monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. This will have been present often for several years before developing full-blown multiple myeloma. There are sometimes other diseases that will present with myeloma, including amyloidosis or unexplained neuropathy. And in many cases, patients will be asymptomatic. In other words, they will only have laboratory abnormalities. And indeed, this is something we would like to have happen more often, because patients who presented with full-blown CRAB criteria often will have major impacts on their quality of life, especially if they have something such as a skeletal-related event leading to a fracture, which causes significant morbidity. And in the next slide, we will often see patients with symptoms greater than 6 months having CRAB criteria. So in other words, they will have been complaining about bone pain for several months. The patient will get a workup, but it may not address directly the bone pain. They may go see somebody to have, say, a spine manipulation, but won't have any real testing done. And again, some patients will be tired, and it'll be a while before a CBC is obtained to show that the patient's anemic, or else the creatinine is rising to account for fatigue, and in cases with altered mental status, calcium will be elevated. For patients who have symptoms less than 3 months, they have less complications, which makes sense. In other words, the symptoms of the bone pain, anemia, renal failure, and hypercalcemia are addressed much quicker and leading to less complications. Now, these are some of the laboratory and radiographic tests that should be considered. For general tests, or for somebody who's just being screened, oftentimes the only manifestation of the myeloma in an asymptomatic patient will be an elevated total protein. However, this is not seen in light chain disease, because light chains are not a cause of an elevated total protein. They're primarily excreted in the urine. And thus, proteinuria will be a manifestation in patients who either have nephrotic syndrome due to a glomerular leak of the albumin due to the myeloma, or else the excess excretion of light chains. Elevated creatinine will occur as the myeloma damages the kidney, and this is something to be considered in a patient, for example, with diabetes, not to ascribe the rising creatinine to diabetes, but to think of myeloma as an exclusion criteria when you are evaluating a patient developing renal failure. As I mentioned earlier, there are many other causes of anemia, but myeloma should be considered during the workup. Hypercalcemia is an often late manifestation, as is a low albumin due to heavy burden of disease, and as well an LDH elevation, which is seen in higher risk disease. For specific tests, immunoglobulin levels, usually IgA, IgG, and IgM are obtained. You often see a rise in the IgA or IgG, which are the more common myeloma proteins. on a serum protein electrophoresis, you'll see the classic M spike, and I'll show you some pictures of that. For the urine, urine protein electrophoresis can be done either on a spot test, and that'll pick up the protein, especially if there's a large amount of it. But sometimes a 24-hour urine test needs to be done to pick up small amounts of protein in the urine, as well as the presence of albumin. And then an immunoelectrophoresis or immunofixation is performed to see if there is or to identify the exact type of monoclonal protein, whether it's IgA, IgM, kappa, or lambda. One thing to remember if a patient has light chain only disease is to test for IgD, because IgD can be elevated in light chain disease, and it's often not part of the routine testing. Other risk factors that are characteristics that are obtained are beta 2 microglobulin. I'll show you how that's important. Bone marrow tests with interface FISH, skeletal survey, MRI or PET scan are also obtained. Classically, we obtain skeletal surveys to look for lytic lesions, but now MRI is a more sensitive test, especially in a patient who has back pain. And a PET CT will also help us find occult disease, especially if you suspect the patient has a higher burden disease and you're not seeing much on the skeletal survey in terms of abnormalities. A bone density scan can also be utilized. We do this sometimes in patients who we don't see lytic lesions, but there's a suspicion that's a soft one on the radiographic findings that the patient may have bone thinning, and a bone density scan will tell you if your patient has accelerated osteoporosis due to the presence of multiple myeloma and is a candidate for early bisphosphonate use. Gene expression profiling is performed on the bone marrow and helps with some forms of risk stratification. Now, this is a busy slide, but it summarizes what I talked about in the previous slide. All the tests are at the top, ranging from the CBC, the chemistry panel, the SPEP, immunoelectrophoresis, as well as the 24-hour urine, serum-free light chains, the bone marrow test, the iFISH, and the radiographic testing, be it skeletal survey, MRI, or PET scan. And if you look on the far right-hand side for MGUS, these are patients who have a serum protein less than 3 grams per deciliter. There's less than 10% clonal plasma cells in the marrow, and there's no end organ damage. These patients can be observed. There are exceptions would be if the patient has, for example, amyloidosis, and that would be an indication for therapy. For smoldering myeloma, these are patients who have a higher level of protein greater than 3 grams per deciliter or greater than 500 milligrams per 24 hours in the urine test, and or light chain restricted bone marrow plasma cells that are between 10 and 60%. There's no CRAB criteria, nor are there any myeloma-defining events. And that's a relatively new criteria, which I'll talk about on the left-hand side. For myeloma requiring therapy, you can have any level of urine or serum M protein. But now what's important is that you have greater than 10% clonal plasma cells or a biopsy-proven plasmacytoma and CRAB criteria, or any myeloma-defining events. Now, these are manifested by greater than 60% bone marrow plasma cells, and an abnormal free light chain ratio of greater than 100 for kappa and less than 0.01 for lambda, and then 2 or more focal lesions on MRI or PET CT examination. And this slide and criteria were adapted from Ian Gobriel and Vincent Rajkumar's articles, which are listed below. So how do we decide therapy and risk factors? We often decide therapy based on performance status and comorbidities rather than age, and that performance status really matters in terms of how well a patient will tolerate therapy. For a patient who's in renal failure, they often will have a decrease in performance status, and it's important to remember that the proteasome inhibitors, in particular bortezomib, is considered a standard treatment for a patient in renal failure as opposed to most IMiDs, which are cleared through the kidneys. Supportive care is very important, anticoagulation in patients receiving IMiDs, zoster prophylaxis for those receiving a proteasome inhibitor, and bisphosphonates to decrease the incidence and severity of skeletal-related events. The ISS, or the International Scoring System, is important for prognostication. I have a slide coming up that goes over that, as well as cytogenetics and molecular testing. can't emphasize the importance of a CD138 selection of the marrow aspirate, as this pulls out the plasma cell selectively to do interface FISH. Metaphase karyotyping is useful for deletion 13. It can be seen on that, but it's not always readily seen. It's better seen on FISH. It's important because deletion 13 is often requires a proteasome inhibitor as part of the initial therapy. Listed below on FISH are 414, 1416, deletion 1P, addition of 1Q, or deletion 17 are all considered higher risk. And the 14 abnormalities as well as 17 have been incorporated into a new scoring system. There are molecular tests that can be done, gene expression profiling, which is a GEP70 or an EMC92, which do identify a very high-risk patient population. However, we're not sure how to aggressively treat these patients. It does, again, identify a high-risk population, but we need to develop better strategies for controlling this, these patients who have very high-risk disease. Other high-risk features include extramedullary disease, plasma cell leukemia at presentation, or high LDH. One other thing to consider is immune dysfunction. Patients will sometimes present with hypogammaglobulinemia, or essentially immune paresis. There's a test called Heavy Light, which sometimes allows you to determine the amount of normal immunoglobulin relative to the clonal protein to tell you if there's suppression of the normal immunoglobulin production. Another way of seeing this is that patients will have lack of protection against a variety of pathogens. You'll find that they no longer have protection against pneumococcus, varicella, tetanus, diphtheria, and that they may need to be revaccinated. So if you have time, it's sometimes advisable to have the patient get vaccinated before they require therapy. If they require therapy right away, it's something that you would consider later on. But it's very important to note that these patients could be at risk for infections because they don't have adequate immunity against standard pathogens for which patients receive vaccinations, as both children and adults. This is the revised ISS scoring for multiple myeloma to report from the IMWG. This is the old criteria on the top, which are based on a beta 2 marker globulin as well as an albumin for patients with high beta 2 greater than 5.5 milligrams per liter or less than 3.5. You now begin to stratify. So patients who are stage 1 have less than 3.5 on the beta 2 and a normal albumin. The stage 3s have greater than 5.5, and the stage 2s are in between, neither 1 nor 3. Now, there's a new way of staging. This came out in 2015, and this is based on cytogenetic and laboratory features. So for stage 1, these are patients who have no risk factors. They don't have a high LDH, nor do they have ISS 2 or 3, and do not have 414, or 1416 or deletion 17 abnormalities on cytogenetic analysis by interface FISH. And you can see here that the patients who are neither 1 nor 3, and 3 are ISS3 and high-risk cytogenetic features by iFISH or a high LDH. And this high LDH, hot, bad cytogenetics, high burden disease population is about 10%. The neither 1 nor 3, the stage 2s are about 60%, and the stage 1s are about 28%. And this is very important to see because the progression-free survival varies from 24 to 36 to 55%, and the 5-year overall survival ranges from 40% to 62 to 82%. So this is very helpful for us understanding risk and prognostication and then tailoring our therapy to be more or less aggressive depending on the patient's revised ISS. This is the proposed algorithm for reclassifying smoldering and active myeloma. It recapitulates some of the things we talked about earlier. On the right-hand side, you'll see high-risk MGUS. These are patients who have less than 10% plasma cells and can be observed. In the middle are patients with no CRAB criteria, but they have greater than 10% clonal plasma cells and or an M protein that's greater than 3 grams per deciliter or 30 grams per liter. For those who have greater than 10% going down, if the serum free light chain ratio is greater than 100 or less than 0.01, these would be patients you would consider as requiring treatment because they have a myeloma defining event. If on whole body MRI, there's one greater than one focal lesion, in other words, two or more focal lesions, these would also be patients to be considered for therapy. So we're now beginning to define a patient population who should be considered for earlier therapy so as to prevent them from developing skeletal-related events or hypercalcemia or renal failure and thus having a major impact on their quality of life. Now, this is a serum protein electrophoresis. I took this from one of our patients who was actually a normal patient who did not have myeloma. On the far left, you'll see the albumin peak, and then it goes alpha 1, alpha 2, beta, and then gamma is on the far right. That's that gently sloping hill. And this is a patient now who has a monoclonal gammopathy. So again, you'll see on the far left albumin, then alpha 1, alpha 2, beta. But now you'll see in the gamma region, you'll see this spike, and thus this is where the terminology M spike comes from. This is about 2 grams per deciliter. And so this is somebody who's developing myeloma. And this is how those diagrams are drawn from. Here on the left-hand side, you'll see serum that's been run through an electrophoresis gel. Again, on the far left is albumin, then alpha 1, alpha 2, beta, and then gamma on the far right. And this is then put through a density photometer, and then allows us to develop the peak to see the quantification of the amount of protein in each peak. On the right-hand side is a kappa-lambda study by immunoelectrophoresis. The top is kappa, the bottom is lambda, and you can see the peaks that are seen. And this is useful in that most patients have about a 60-40 ratio of kappa to lambda. And if you see only one, in other words, it's restricted to kappa or lambda, that suggests and defines a monoclonal protein. Now, this is a normal urine electrophoresis over 24 hours. You'll see there's a tiny amount of albumin on the far left, a little peak. And then here's a patient with light chain disease where you'll now see on the far right a large peak, which are the light chains being spilled in the urine. If you have a patient with nephrotic syndrome, you'll see a lot of albumin, or if you've got glomerular leak, you will see a lot of immunoglobulin being passed through, again, because you are spilling protein due to the fact that the glomeruli no longer are filtering out larger proteins. This is something from those of you who took hematology classes in medical school. You'll see the rouleau formation. We don't use this now. It's more for historical purposes, but you'll see the red cell stack like coins flipped over, and this is due to the high protein in the blood that causes the cells to aggregate together when they're made into smears for CBC examination. You can see a patient here on the left-hand side. You'll see arrows pointing to holes in the patient's arm bones showing lytic lesions. And then on the right-hand side, it's hard to see, but on the clavicle, you'll see arrows pointing to it, and the clavicle is misaligned. And the reason why it's misaligned is this patient had a clavicular fracture, and he didn't even know it. And so that will sometimes happen in non-weight-bearing bones. Patients will fracture things, and they may not have even realized it until you actually do the skeletal survey. Here again are more lytic lesions, as seen as by the black punched-out lesions in the long bones. And you worry about this in places such as the femur, where you have now weight-bearing long bones that can collapse due to the lytic lesion, and these may need to be addressed orthopedic-wise to prevent a major catastrophe for the patient. This is a patient who has, you can see it is 30 millimeters. You'll see a very faint shadow. There's an arrow pointing to it. It's a large 30-millimeter lesion. In the calvarium, you'll see some other lesions that are punched out, and the skull films are often a common place to see the lytic lesions in multiple myeloma. Now, here are the evil cells themselves. These are plasma cells. They have an eccentric nucleus and then a grayish-white cytoplasm. The cytoplasm is filled with immunoglobulin, and with special stains, you can actually see the immunoglobulin within the cytoplasm. Here's a kappa stain where the pathologist has stained it for kappa only, and you can see that the plasma cells in this case are all stained brown. In other words, they're kappa restricted. If this were a polyclonal situation, you would see a mix of both kappa and lambda. Here's the counter stain with lambda, showing that there's an absence of lambda. Why? Because these plasma cells are almost exclusively kappa. Now, this is fish. And I show these slides because it's kind of interesting to see how fish takes place. And what the cytogeneticist does is develop probes. In this case, the green probe is to the centromere of chromosome 17. The red probe is to the P53 location on chromosome 17. So normally what you expect to see is one green and one red signal for each chromosome. So two red signals, two green signals. That's a normal pattern. But if you see now the loss of the red signal, this is a P53 deletion. The red signal is gone. You can see the red and the green signal together, but on the normal chromosome, but the abnormal chromosome has the deletion. On the right-hand side, we now see a green probe for CDKN2C, the short arm at 1P, and the red probe is CKS1B, which is the long arm of 1Q. So gains of the long arm show 3 to 4 signals. So you can see here, this is a 1Q plus, where you now have 4 signals on the interface fish. This is the immunoglobulin heavy chain rearrangement, 14Q. The 5' portion is green, and the 3' portion is red. So normal, you'll see a green-red overlap fusion signal, which you see right there at the bottom, the fusion signal. And when they pull apart, with the red and the green being separated, that is the break in this region, so you know that the heavy chain has been rearranged. On the right-hand side, we don't have a normal cell, but here you would expect to see two green signals and two red signals showing a pattern for chromosome 13, and you only see one green and one red signal showing that this is a patient who has monosomy 13. Hyperdiploidy is another manifestation of myeloma. Often the odd number chromosomes are duplicated. So probes detecting 3 chromosomes, 5, 9, and 15 are shown. 5 is green, 9 is aqua, and 15 is red. And as you can see here, there are 3 copies of chromosome 5, thus demonstrating the trisomy. And then on the right-hand side, we have another immunoglobulin heavy chain rearrangement. This is with chromosome 11. IGH is in green. CCNB1, which is a marker for chromosome 11Q13, that's the location of 11, is in red. And normally what you'll see is one red and one green. And what we'll see abnormally is you'll see a fusion. So when you have a fusion of the signals, as manifested by the dots that are on top of each other, that is the translocation of 1114. Whereas if you see the signals separated, that's normal. And this is actually very important now that we have venetoclaxes in the side. Venetoclax targets patients who have 1114 chromosome abnormality, and this will hopefully be something that we'll be utilizing for this patient population. So we're beginning to see how important these cytogenetic abnormalities are with regards to prognosis in assigning therapy. I'm going to finish with talking about relapse and progression. Relapse from CR is the reappearance of serum or urine and proteins detected only by immunofixation. Requires 2 separate assessments. That's very important to really confirm progression / or relapse. You want to have greater than 5% plasma cells in the bone marrow aspirate or biopsy. There are new lytic bone lesions or soft tissue plasmacytomas, or definite increase in size of the lesions. That's another indication of relapse. A compression fracture alone does not exclude continued response. It's very important to make sure you confirm progression by another indication. And then hypercalcemia in the absence of other cause will lead to a patient undergoing workup to look for the presence of clonal cells or clonal protein. Now, progression is a little different. This is a higher volume of disease. So the relapse will be from a complete remission, whereas disease progression is a higher amount. So it's a greater than 25% increase in serum M protein, an absolute increase of 0.5 grams per deciliter, and a 25% increase in urine protein, and an absolute increase of 200 milligrams over 24 hours, depending on what you're measuring. And for free light chain ratio, there needs to be an absolute increase of greater than 10 milligrams per deciliter. But this is only in patients who do not have measurable paraprotein in serum and urine. And the majority of patients will either have urine or serum proteins that can be measured. There also should be a 25% increase in plasma cells in the bone marrow aspirate or biopsy. And it needs to be an absolute increase of at least 10%. As mentioned, with the relapse from progression, we need to see an increase in the size of existing bone lesions or soft tissue plasmacytomas, development of new lesions or plasmacytomas. And again, compression fracture alone is not enough to call progression. And again, hypercalcemia that is not attributable to another cause should be an indication for workup to see if the patient has occult or occult disease. So I'm going to finish up. This is a paired sample analysis from the Mayo group, and it's a rather complicated diagram showing clonal evolution over time. And what they show here, blowing up this portion of the slide, is that this is probably a first hit that leads to a pre-condition, maybe MGUS, then a progenitor abnormality, and then on the right-hand side, you'll see diagnosis and then relapse. And of the relapses, they find that the same abnormalities seen at diagnosis are often seen at relapse, but in about a third of the patients. And then in a third of the patients at relapse, there'll be new changes seen only in about a third of the patients. And then on the left-hand side at the bottom, you'll see both old and new abnormalities. And this is really demonstrated in this slide. This is a patient, who had clone 1.1 in red at diagnosis. The patient received lenalidomide dex, and then went into remission. This clone was still present, continued on it, and then at disease relapse, clone 2.1 in green was the predominant clone. The patient received a carfilzomib containing salvage, clone 2.1 decreased, but now clone 1.2 arose. And then the patient received a bortezomib, an investigational drug. You'll see control of disease. But then over time, you'll now see a new clone, 2.2, which is manifested as plasma cell leukemia. And this patient had had progressive disease with a completely different set of clones than what was seen at diagnosis. So this points out the importance of considering a full workup, including bone marrow, aspirate for iFISH to make sure that the patient has not developed new cytogenetic abnormalities, which may target therapy. So these are the laboratory and radiographic tests to consider for routine follow-up. On the left, you would want to measure every 3 to 4 months a chemistry panel with LDH, an SPEP, an immunoelectrophoresis, and serum free light chains, possibly a 24-hour urine, especially in somebody with nephrotic syndrome, and then a CBC. For suspected relapse or progression, we'd want to look at the laboratory abnormalities that might be developing, in other words, a rising M protein or serum free light chains, as well as symptoms such as pain requiring radiographic testing, either a skeletal survey or perhaps an MRI PET scan to look for occult disease. And then a bone marrow test with CD138 selected FISH to help us guide treatment. So this is what we consider if we have a patient who is asymptomatic, they have laboratory abnormalities alone, do we want to treat with early disease, or do we want to wait for the patient to fulfill criteria for progressive disease? At a minimum, if they fulfill criteria for progressive disease, they need to be treated. If they're early on, they may be able to be watched for a few months, but very carefully to make sure they don't have a rapid progression, which would potentially lead to end organ damage. If they're symptomatic, there's a need for earlier therapy. If they've had progression beyond 6 to 9 months from their last treatment, as opposed to within that time period, you may want to tailor your therapy differently. You sometimes can look at a previous regimen, especially if it's been a long time since they were exposed to the original treatment. And unlike many solid tumors, you can reutilize previous therapies, especially when combining with a new therapy. So, for example, elotuzumab with Lendex, or Dara with Lendex, or Dara with bortezomib Dex, or carfilzomib Lendex, or pomalidomide index, and panobinostat bortezomib Dex. These are just some of the options that we now have, and we're going to get better at figuring out how we can sequence all of these in controlling disease. So this is an algorithm which I borrowed from Donna Reese and adapted from Dr. Rohlig from The Lancet in 2015. And you'll see that patients need to be considered based on performance status, age, and comorbidities. If they're fit, they can be considered for a transplant. If they're frail, they're older, chemotherapy until progression versus fixed duration. At time of progression, then we have to think about what regimens to use, and we now have a variety of options depending on the type of relapse aggressive or less aggressive. It may tailor our therapy. So the key points today are that multiple myeloma and related disorders should be considered in patients with symptoms such as back pain and fatigue. Myeloma and related disorders should be considered in patients with anemia and mild renal insufficiency, even those with pre-existing conditions, especially with those, because you don't want to ascribe the renal insufficiency to diabetes or hypertension. It turns out they're developing myeloma. Myeloma and related disorders can occur without an elevated serum total protein, so it's something to consider. Thus, serum-free light chains and even electrophoresis should be considered. A complete workup includes a serum LDH, beta-2 microglobulin, and bone marrow test with CD138 selected FISH, as it's very critical for risk assessment, and a full workup at the time of disease progression can help guide salvage therapy. And I thank you all for viewing this activity.